Good morning,
welcome,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
How are you today?
Good day. So you have the mayor of the city of Houston with you this morning?
I do. I'm very pleased to have some of my constituents from southeastern Minnesota. Got up probably at dark 30 this morning and hit the road and made it up here for the first to testify. We have a bill that's related to the unallotment that the governor targeted to cities of populations under 1,000. And the city of Houston is clearly in that area, and yet they were targeted for unallotment and suffered cuts of 27,000 in the first year and projections of 50-some thousand to come. That's an extreme hardship on this community, and we can demonstrate that Houston should not have been in that capture pool to begin with. They're under 1,000, and then I think there was a tax capacity qualifier as well, and they are underneath that benchmark. So this should have been a community that was shaken through the grates and passed over for LGA. They got caught. So what we're here today to do is explain to you what the community situation is, what the facts and the data are, what the demographics are, and then we're going to ask that they have their $26,000 restored from the last cut, and you'll hear about some of the hardships that's created. And if the committee cannot find $26,000 under a rock somewhere, Mr. Chair, we would hope that they may be credited for future taxation, and then certainly taken off the list for next year's cut. Okay. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Connie Edwards, the mayor of Houston.
Welcome to the committee, Mayor Edwards. And
thank you.
Proceed.
I was a little nervous about coming today because I thought, oh, my gosh, what am I going to say? Senator said, just tell your story.
If you could first say your name.
Oh,
for
I'm
the
sorry.
Tape so we can
I'm
recognize
Connie Edwards, voice. Mayor of the city of Houston.
Thank you.
About a year ago, last summer, last June, it wasn't even a year ago, last June, we heard about the LGA cuts coming down, and we heard that the governor was going to exempt cities under 1,000. And the first year they had the cuts come through, we were at 1,003, we took the cuts, and the next year came out and the demographer's office said our numbers were at 989, and we thought, wow, good, we're going to be exempt from the cuts again this year. And as it went, we started making some phone calls, and they said, well, no, they're still going to use the 2007 numbers. And I said, well, no, we're at 989. We shouldn't be cut. So we started to follow through the channels as we thought appropriate, starting out with the Department of Revenue, and said, you know, we're at 989. We shouldn't have these unallotments. And they said, well, nothing we can do. And then from there, we thought, okay. So then Minnesota Small Cities Association got involved and talked to somebody else at the Department of Revenue who talked to the commissioner and pretty much said, there's nothing we can do. I thought, okay, now where do I go? Governor's office. So I was talking to Brian in the governor's office, and he's going through the whole thing. And he said, there's really nothing we can do. He says, you need to go to the legislature. They're the ones that need to change the 2007 number. So basically where we're at is we're being penalized, I guess, for lack of a better word, for the 2007 number of 1,003. And going forward, when we're looking at all the unallotments, we're being unallotted for 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, you know, and so on, because of the 2007 number, where we're clearly under. I did do went to the demographer center to say, are we the only city that this affected? And we truly are the only city in the state of Minnesota that dropped below that number. And none of them went above either, you know, going on the flip side of the coin. So we are truly the only city in Minnesota that's affected by this. You know, some big cities might look at it and say, well, 29, 22,000, easy numbers to come up with, you know, cut a little off your budget. And we did. We did cut a little off our budget. We froze salaries. We have a maintenance personnel leaving, and we're not going to replace him. So now we're down to two cops, two maintenance men, a city administrator. I think we have six employees. So we have nowhere else to cut. We can't raise taxes. We have 989 people. So to start making up 29, you know, 22, you know, the different numbers coming up this year, if the unallotments stay in effect at the 2007 numbers, If, with the proposed unallotments coming up, we have 55,000 plus an additional 62,000 if the governor's proposed unallotments come in. That's over $110,000 to come up with for a town of 989 people. It's almost impossible. We have equipment breaking down every day, and we just told them at the council meeting Monday night, well, we know well number three is out, but we know you need a plow truck, but we have all these cuts. There's nothing we can do, so I guess you don't get a plow truck. You get the well instead. And our hands are greatly tied by this, and I guess what we're asking for is just to truly go back to the true numbers of, you know, the governor's intent of the, you know, his first unallotments was cities under 1,000. And we're just trying to go back to the original intent of the governor and recognize our number as the 989 as it's put out by the state demographer's office.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Rickenropes.
I just want to say for this committee who isn't familiar with the character of the city of Houston that they are famous for their frugality. And I think you heard the governor mention they have one police car. They have two policemen. They don't even have 24-hour police coverage right now. They blew out one of their pumper trucks during the flood, and it's been an incredible hardship to try to find funds and round up any kind of money to get that replaced. So they're in an extreme situation here. Mr. Chair, we have also with us Dave Engstrom, who's executive director of the Minnesota Associations of Small Cities.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Dave Engstrom, executive director of the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. I really don't have too much to add other than what Mayor Edwards has said. She did mention that Houston is in a unique situation. We did some research, and there was one other city that came close, but it still did not make the grade that Houston's making, which can show that its population is below 1,000. The other item that was in the last unallotments, or the other part of the formula for the cities under 1,000, was the property tax capacity per capita. And if a city had, even if it was under 1,000, had a greater than the 1157 property tax capacity per capita, the statewide average of 1157, it lost. So there was about 40 cities, maybe a few more, 45 cities that did lose, even though they were under 1,000. And Houston, when you look at their property tax capacity per capita, is 430. So they're less than half the statewide average. So they are in a very unique and difficult situation.
Thank you, Mr. Engstrom. And city administrator?
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Jervis?
Larry Jervis, city administrator. I'll answer questions mainly if you have any, but just a couple of quick things. The 2010 proposed cut to our state aid would add up to 35% of our existing state aid and would be 22% of our 2010 general fund budget. So it's quite a major thing for us. And then just quickly, another thing, just to show how snake bit we seem to be, we got a letter from the Department of Revenue requesting part of our 2007 disaster aid be refunded to the state. So just another little thing on top of everything else. And I'll answer questions or whatever if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Jervis and Senator Rickenropes. You know, we'll certainly take this under consideration. A lot of times when we do these LGA adjustments, we do it within the LGA pool. And so it's a shifting off from other communities to the community making the request. It's harder to do that, you know, when that's a reducing number. And the administration has proposed to reduce LGA further. Now, I think the Senate Tax Committee is trying to find some other mechanisms, but we certainly are going to take this under consideration. Questions, members? Senator Pogue-Miller.
Chairman, just for you and the staff to look at, it looks like if you just use 208 rather than 207, it might net out. I'm looking at one city that went the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
So it might just net out.
Mr. Chairman, that's actually what we're asking for, is for the 2008 numbers to be used, the more accurate census numbers for years to come. We understand the first year with the 2008 unallotment that they would use the 2007 numbers with the first cut, but we're asking that years going forward from that, that they would use the accurate 2008 numbers.
Okay, thank you. And good to understand that. Well, we will take this under consideration. We'll look and see if it does net out. We'll see what happens to LGA and the overall picture of this. And anything else, members? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question then about the language in the bill. It does say on the appropriation under sub 2 there that we would be taking the appropriation out of the general fund. Is that going to be a problem if you're talking about taking it out of the LGA pool?
Senator Erickson-Ropes, we certainly will work with you as we're going to lay this on the table today, and as we put our bill together as we go through the session, we'll be in touch with your office and see what some other options are, if there are any, where it looks like we're going to go. So we'll be in touch with you and your office and see what we can figure out.
So we can adapt the language later then?
We can change the language later,
okay.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Anybody in the audience that would like to testify against this Senate file? Any other questions, members? Seeing none, Chair lays Senate file 2435 over for possible inclusion. Thank you for coming up here. Thank you this morning.
Thank you very much.
And Senator Erickson-Ropes, do you want to do your other bill as long as you're here?
I believe I'm going to take a break. Senator Phoebe or somebody else is going to jump in between.
Why don't you go ahead? Well, I think we'll just keep going as your testifiers are here.
I don't know that they are, sir. That's why I want to
take
a little break.
Well, step back.
All right.
Okay. That's
Thank
fine.
You.
Senator Murphy?
What's he got? Where are we at this morning?
Morning, Senator Murphy.
Morning, Mr. Chairman.
Start with Senate File 2542, St. Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Senate File 2542 is a response to some declining aid for the community of St. Charles. And, you know, we've been in front of your committee before, and I'm not going to go into detail about all the plight and disasters that have come upon the city of St. Charles. I think you just heard the city of Houston. They've got a similar story to tell. But this is just a little bit different than what they're trying to do. And I'm going to have, Mr. Chairman, if you allow Ms. Zoff to maybe speak to an amendment that needs to go on this bill so that we can kind of keep it working in the system here. But the bottom line is there's what we're trying to do is capture future revenue or future projections, I should say, and you know, base this type of aid to the city upon that. Evidently, there's some mechanisms that don't quite work, and council has come up with an amendment that will keep us in play for right now. And I think we're going to work on it a little bit and try to get it resolved with the House author and the House staff. But this is a pretty complicated issue. I'd rather her explain it than me continue to stumble.
Ms. Zoff, the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, members, the A2 amendment takes care of a couple technical issues that came up in this bill. The first part of the amendment just specifies that the payment to the city would be paid just with the December payment of local government aid rather than split into two parts, which is what is done under the reference to Section 477A.015. The second part of the amendment on lines 1.4 to 1.9 recognizes that when the amount that was paid to the Independent School District was less than the amount that had been appropriated originally, The difference was adjusted for in the forecast. So this takes into account that the difference that would be payable to the city of St. Charles would be what remains after that forecast adjustment.
And Ms. Soff, why is the independent school district being used for this calculation for the city LGA?
Mr. Chairman, the original bill that was passed last year, and you can see the bill if you look at, or you can see last year's law set forth in Senate File 2542. That's what's being amended. Last year there was a provision that was passed that set forth here that provided additional declining pupil unit aid for the school district in St. Charles to recognize the population that was lost because of the fire at the meatpacking plant. What this bill proposes as it's drafted currently is to take what wasn't paid that had been appropriated for this purpose or had been anticipated, the $242,000, whatever was left over because the declining pupil unit wasn't as high as they had expected, would be paid instead to the city.
Okay, I'm tracking. I'm not sure I'm clear on the connection, but at least I'm tracking what the process is. Maybe we should hear from your testifier, Senator Murphy, and they can help walk us through this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe the mayor would like to go first here, since he's in charge. Mayor Spitzer.
Mr. Chair, members of the Tax Committee, I appreciate the opportunity to come in front of you today. Obviously, maybe I should start out with why we're here. Basically, in the last few years, St. Charles has been a
sir,
part of a...
Could you say your name for the team,
yes,
please?
Yes, Bill Spitzer, Mayor of St. Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Yes, sir. And we've had a few disasters that have... taken place in our community, and a few of them that have lost significant jobs. And one of the things that we're trying to do, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is trying to restore some of those jobs to our area. And the information that you have in front of you, or will have in front of you shortly, is basically our plan to become economically resilient. We want to make sure that we do that, and sustainability is very important for us in the city of St. Charles. So at this point, what I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, is turn it over to our city administrator. He has a very short presentation for you, yourself and the members of the committee.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, my name is Nick Coverman. I am the city administrator. We have a short presentation that we have printed off for you, a copy that we are working with our current local business partners and our school district. And the question was initially, why is the school district on board with us? And the fear with the loss of North Star Foods and those 250 jobs is that the majority of those folks were Hispanic. And they live in St. Charles and have lived in St. Charles for the last three, 4 decades, because St. Charles is a community that welcomes diversity. When North Star left, some of those folks did leave for other jobs in Nebraska, South Carolina, Iowa, California, back to Texas even. But a lot of those folks remained because of St. Charles's welcoming environment. And we worked with the school district because a lot of those families remained because of our school district, because there was hope for the jobs for North Star Foods to come back. Unfortunately, in January, that didn't happen. But we had been working with the owners for the last several months to devise a plan to bring those folks and those jobs back. And the presentation that we have today is that plan and how to invest those dollars. And I'm sure as you hear throughout the next several weeks, there are communities that are struggling throughout Minnesota, and we are all learning how do we become economically resilient. And for St. Charles, because of the 2009 fire, we lost $290,000 in actual dollars for water, sewer, and electric. Those dollars we can see, and we could say that, you know, we lost bricks and mortar as well. But I would argue that the greater loss are those jobs and those families to St. Charles. But we still have an opportunity to retain those folks. Over the last several years since I have been city administrator, the community has intrinsically learned to be economically resilient. But it's something that we forge and strive to be every day. Resilience is the capacity to absorb shocks to any system, both economically and, I would argue, naturally. In 2007, we suffered fires, and we nearly lost two of our major employers as well, but we worked with them to bring them back because of our Minnesota desire to be self-sufficient and to grow on our own. In 2009, of course, we lost North Star Foods, and only 30 days later, we lost one of our oldest congregations to a fire. So we are a product of that. Resilience allows us to, even in the most extreme moments, keep learning to change, and that's what we strive to do. You'll notice some pictures in our presentation that we've done. Our goal with partnering with our legislators and representatives is to use not only our existing infrastructure that we have put into St. Charles and to capitalize on that, but to look to partner to bring those jobs back to St. Charles. And that's listed out in our objective for the Community Resiliency Plan, to create jobs, increase our tax bases once again, and to stay competitive with not only within our region, but also with states, so that we can say that we are able to compete on a national and regional basis. So what is our plan for the investment of those dollars? As the legislation reads initially, it's stated for the losses of North Star Foods. Could we do a one-time Band-Aid for our community? Absolutely. And that's a decision that the council will need to make ultimately. However, it's been the core focus and of the steering group that we formed to invest those dollars for long-term sustainability of our community. So through working with North Star Foods, we investigated various properties and where was the vision of St. Charles. We've worked with MnDOT on securing access to a proposed business park that some of you have probably heard about. It's a 37-acre site located on our I-90 access, which is untapped and is the next step for St. Charles. MnDOT has been gracious enough to work with us. It is part of our comprehensive plan. And we've already made the investment back in 2000 with about $400,000 in water and sewer close to that property, but this would be the next step. Those monies that we're looking to secure through this bill would help pay for some of the water and sewer and road necessarily to continue that vision. As we've talked with potential business owners, they're very excited about this opportunity. And we haven't even released it publicly yet because we're still forming our vision with your help and with our business community help. The potential partners that we've been working with are listed towards the back of the presentation. And through deed, Senator Murphy's office, Senator Ann Lynch, Representative Steve Draskowski, numerous business partners, MnDOT, the Southeastern Minnesota Development Corporation, and the Minnesota Economic Development Foundation. They see the value in our vision, but it's the resources that we need to pull together to help make that vision come true.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. And, sir?
This is an amendment. Good morning, Mr. Chair and fellow committee members. My name is Chris Gassner. I'm the Economic Development Director for the City of St. Charles. And like Administrator Coverman said, what we're trying to do is put together a plan that utilizes resources in the short term to make a long-term investment in rebuilding our community, both from the natural disasters that we had currently been working on and then the economic disaster of losing one of our largest employers or our largest private employer. So we're looking for your support in being able to move forward with a plan that can help build St. Charles into the future as Administrator Coverman said, an economically resilient community to be able to face whatever disasters may be down the road.
Thank you. And so Senator Murphy, St. Charles has made the case. I mean, they did this last year, evidently in the K-12 division, to appropriate this money for the declining students. And the declining students at the schools didn't occur. And so now the proposal is to use the money that would have gone to the school district to go to the city to help them with their business park development. Am I getting the gist of all of this accurately?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
What's the amount?
Is it the 242,000? Am I reading the number right?
It's some difference from 242. What is the difference?
Right.
Unfortunately, Mr. Chair, we don't have the exact amount that was appropriated to the school district, so we don't know what the amount that would be asking for. We would have to get that information before we would have a stable number.
Senator Pogemiller, I've been told it will be a forecasted amount from the education committee, and we'll have to get that number and see where that is.
Can we do this?
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'm looking at the idea you have proposed before us, and I'm just kind of thinking in a big macroeconomic way. We're taking if I get this right, we're taking economic dollars that would have gone to your area, but due to declining pupil population, you want to keep the same dollar amount but move it into an economic development purpose. Now, with that premise,
well, Senator Limmer, I think that the declining pupils did not occur.
It did not.
Did not occur. And so they were appropriated money to help the school deal with declining students. That did not occur because the community was able to retain some of its population and workforce. Now they're looking for businesses for those individuals to work at. I think that's pretty close to accurate.
Right. Mr. Chair, that's because they had a loss in business due to the natural disaster that occurred.
Yeah, I think they've had a number of issues from a fire and a flood, a number of quite, hard events for communities.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, we had the flood back in August of 2007. You know, it was like a week and a half after the 35W bridge fell down.
Yeah.
2 weeks, I suppose. But, that created a havoc in our area. And, we still have several communities that are struggling to make up for that. I mean, the city of Houston was here earlier today. I'm sure you're going to hear from a couple other communities from our neck of the woods. But then the largest employer in town, this meatpacking plant caught on fire, and there goes a substantial number of jobs. And I think the mayor and Nick point out to the, loss that meant, not only in quality employment, but just straight-out dollars. I mean, $290,000 loss in utility payments from that one business alone. They've done the hard work to reconfigure their budget so that they can make those losses work and still provide good public service. This is the next step. It's a it's a positive next step because St. Charles is situated in a really good geographical spot. I mean, you've got a couple of one interstate just runs right to the south of the city, and then State Trunk Highway that runs over to Winona. Both run over towards Winona and towards Rochester. So it's a great place, and it's a great opportunity for some businesses to move in there. They're talking about a business park that is, it's going to be very business friendly. And with that comes jobs. And if we don't want our pupil aid to decline because families can't find these jobs in St. Charles, We better do something now to make sure that we get employment there. I understand your hesitance about, like, capturing this forecasted education dollar and spending it in another area. I think that we've got a little, the Senate takes a little different perspective than the House in that regard. But the idea is solid, that there is this money that is forecasted out there. It's actually real dollars. This is kind of a cost. This is a cost neutral bill. Mm-hmm. We're just going to capture those dollars and provide, hopefully, some employment opportunities. And you know, this is one of the good things about some of the communities that I represent. You know, I went through the flood, and you know, everybody rolled up their sleeves and got down to it, Senator. And it was, you know, this is these folks are trying to take care of themselves. And you know, the other thing is cost neutral. Mm-hmm. I can understand your heartburn, but Ms. Zoff and the chair, and we'll get that figured out.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Murphy, you may be getting ahead of me a little bit. I'm not sure if I have a lot of heartburn about it. I appreciate the creativity that this bill represents. And
creative.
Yeah. And, you know, unlike other times when we're trying to react to an emergency situation after the fact, we just keep stacking expense on top of expense. And this is one of the first times I've had the pleasure of looking at something that's a little more creative. And it recognizes the loss, but it also recognizes the need to keep the pupils there. It also recognizes a whole bunch of other things. So I'm just trying to get my brain wrapped around this concept and make sure I understand it before I vote.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Murphy, in order to get this bill in the form that you want this, we need to adopt the A2 amendment. Senator Senjum, move the A2 amendment. excuse me. Ms. Zoff has explained this earlier, but it's relatively technical, but it gets the language to work in the order that the testifiers have been discussing it. So any questions, members? The A2 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. To the Senate file 2542 as amended. Any other questions, members?
Mr. Chairman, I think the mayor wanted to kind of.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank you for this opportunity. And just to respond back to Senator Limmer, thank you very much for you know, complimenting our creativity. One of the things that we look at is every disaster offers opportunities for us. So we're taking it as an opportunity, not just looking at the disaster. And we want to make sure that we retain those students so then we don't have to go down the road and have to you know, subsidize the school district. So we're trying to create the jobs to keep those families in our community, and that's one of the goals of this request that we're making. So thank you very much.
You bet.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair, I live in Rochester. St. Clair, Charles is 20 miles to the east. And I would just say from the outside looking in, and, you know, as you live in any area of the state, you look around at different communities and you look at their strengths. And St. Charles, I think, is one of those communities with this can-do attitude. And even though, you know, they've gone through a couple of disasters here, which have been, you know, powerfully effective or affecting on their community. Again, they bring to this legislature this year this bill, which I think is has been described as creative. But it's also, you know, if we can just maybe just give these folks a little bit of a jump start, they are absolutely the kind of community that can and has in the past just moved forward in a strong way. They're a community with an identity onto themselves, and they've made things happen in the past, and they will in the future.
And Senator Senjum, I agree. You know, Minnesota, just in general, we all kind of think we can do, and a lot of times the state has a role to play in helping that can do happen. So, anything else, members? Chair will lay Senate File 2542 as amended over for possible inclusion. Thank you for coming up. Thank you, Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Murphy, did you want to do 2334?
Sure.
Also, now, as long as you're here. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 2334 is a bill which would take the practice of donating unsold goods to a charity. Right now that gets taxed, and this would take the sales tax off of that. So, Mr. Chairman, say you own, the Quick Trip down the street, and you got in two dozen more, well, I can't use food products. Say you got in two dozen more pairs of gloves, those $1 pair of gloves that you hang on the rack next to the door. Say you got in two dozen boxes more than what you had ordered, but you'd already paid for them. Well, you didn't need them, and you're not going to be able to keep them around, so you'd take it and you'd, give it to the Salvation Army or whatever. Well, the department says that that should be taxed. Or that the value of those goods should be taxed that you give away as charitable donations. Now, I think, charity's charity. And if you're giving something away, I don't know why we would want to use the practice of taxing that. And that's simply what the bill does. I know that, that there's probably more than one person here to come and talk about their issue in this, and so I guess there's a different side to every coin, but we're the legislature, and sometimes what we legislate gets convoluted, and I think that this is one of those.
And Senator Murphy, when you were in talking with the department about this, did they indicate what the fiscal ramifications were for them in the state?
Mr. Chairman, no, and I haven't really seen a fiscal note, but
Senator Murphy, I do have a fiscal note now.
Oh.
Looks like a couple million, $2,750,000.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it looks like it would cost about $3 million a year over the next 3 years.
Well, let's take a look at that.
But the bottom line is, Mr. Chairman, is evidently there's a place where businesses, charitable, that give away things can get a credit or some sort of exemption. Mm-hmm. On the front end of purchases that they make. I was not aware of that, and I believe there's probably somebody here that can speak better to it than I can. But, the bottom line is that they're giving this stuff away, basically, to people who don't have anything, and I just don't understand why there would be a tax on that type of activity to begin with, but obviously we did that, so I just don't understand the logic behind it.
Yep. Any questions, members? Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I see this is another brilliant bill. I'm a co-author. But I just had a question. Maybe it's a question for the department. But I'm just wondering how this works logistically. At what point does the department collect the tax on items like this? Do they collect the tax after it's been rung up at the till, or I guess I just it's a basic business practice I'm not familiar with, or when the merchandise comes through the front door, the tax is paid by the merchant.
Commissioner, do you before they sell it to the public? To help us so I'm wondering, or do you want to come and help?
So
us?
I guess my real question is: do these merchants pay the tax on these goods at the point at which so they're sending them down the street to a charity to give away, Is that the point at which they pay the tax to the Department of Revenue? Just a question.
Commissioner Ines.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And unfortunately, we don't have a sales tax person here in this committee at this time. I apologize for that, Chairman, to answer that question. I don't know about the mechanics of it, Senator Dibble. I can get back to you on that. But I have been told that the longstanding practice has been that these items would be taxable. So it's been a longstanding practice, and that in order to do the exemption, we'd have to do something along Senator Murphy's lines. But I'll get back to you on them. Just at the mechanics, when the point of sale occurs, when the tax is remitted, those kind of issues.
Right. Thanks.
Apologize.
Commissioner, along those veins, the question I have is, so they've made the donation, and then they're going to deduct that value off of their income. Do they also then deduct the sales tax as part of that value?
Chairman, I see Ms. Allen shaking her head vigorously, but I will clarify that as well.
Mr. Chair, the value of the item would include whatever sales tax was paid by the retailer or the merchant. Okay. So that by actually enacting this, you're going to lower their income tax deduction.
Thank you, Ms. Allen. I think we'll need to walk through this a little bit to see what the implications are. Right. It might not be anything to the business.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and earlier after talking with Ms. Allen and some other folks, it seems like there's, it's not my intention to create some sort of double negative taxation, but just, something that is fair. And looking around at everybody around the table, I can tell that I've managed to confuse everybody now. So we must be headed in the right direction, but I think we need to understand this a little bit better, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other? Senator Dibble.
But it does kind of remind me of the, our ongoing discussion about the sales tax refund on capital equipment. Kind of, they pay the tax and then apply for a refund. This might be along those lines, kind of how do we efficiently address the sales tax issue with charitable contributions. I just see a parallel in the discussion.
Well, and Chairman, Senator Dibble, and we still haven't remedied that.
Commissioner Ines.
That's been a longstanding issue. I think we all agree as a policy matter.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an issue we've wrestled with for a decade.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we'll take a look and see if we can understand this. Anything else, members?
So have another decade to go on this.
Yeah. Anybody in the audience that wants to testify on this? Seeing none, Chair will lay over Senate File 2334 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Senator Erickson Ropes and Senator Salzman. Wisconsin reciprocity.
Morning again, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senator Salzman and I decide we are going to tag team you this morning. We both have tax reciprocity bills because they affect the constituents in our area very significantly. And Senator Salzman has been working in her district, and I've been working on mine, and we also did a little bit of collaborative work with a group of the stakeholders. So basically what I'd like to tell you is that there has been a tax reciprocity agreement with the state of Wisconsin for Minnesota residents who cross the border daily and work in Wisconsin and vice versa Wisconsin residents who live there and come over to work in Minnesota. And Governor Doyle and Governor Pawlenty both dissolved the tax reciprocity agreement this year. I think there were some financial concerns on Governor Pawlenty's part where he could capture several $100 million by dissolving the tax reciprocity agreement. Some of the concerns that we have on this side, in particular my district, and Senator Salzman will talk about hers, but Houston County is one of the counties in my district in southeastern Minnesota. We have more commuters in Houston County that cross the border every day, jump across the Mississippi River to work in Wisconsin. I have 3,000 workers every day that drive over to Wisconsin to work, and that's the largest number of commuters affected by this tax reciprocity law in the state. But every other county up and down the eastern border of the state is affected by this law. In Minnesota, the governor can singularly end the tax reciprocity agreement. In Wisconsin, it's a legislative action. And one of the provisions of my bill moves it from just an executive authority and places the authority to end the tax reciprocity agreement with the legislature, and then, of course, the governor would be involved with that as signing into law. Just the fact that the governor alone can make a decision like this puts him in a position where he is single-handedly capable of raising taxes on citizens without any kind of legislative input, without any representation from the taxpayers whatsoever. And that's what happened in my district. I'm hearing from commuters who are saying their taxes are going to go up $300, $400 a year just because we've walked away from the tax reciprocity agreement. And for a lot of my commuters, that's a huge increase. And, again, the bottom line here seems to be that one person has been able to raise those taxes. So my bill moves the authority from the executive branch to the legislative branch, and then additionally requests that we continue the reciprocity agreement. Senator Saltzman's bill takes on another issue that has been a complicating factor in the whole process, and I will let her or turn over the mic to Senator Saltzman.
Welcome to the committee, Senator
Saltzman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if I could put forward the A1 author's amendment on Senate File 3017.
Senator Dibble will move the A1 amendment. And this is your first stop?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate you hearing this bill today because it has been a difficult fall. And I also want to just, you know, point out you have some handouts with you that really reflect a lot of what Senator Erickson Ropes talked about in terms of numbers and also gives you an overview of the income tax reciprocity between Minnesota and Wisconsin and just a little bit more of an update. Last fall, I was contacted by Senator Sheila Harsdorf, who is the senator on the other side of my district in Wisconsin, and we've worked a lot together on transportation issues and some other issues because we border our, you know, communities. And she asked me, was there anything we could do to help save the reciprocity agreement? And they were critical of Governor Pawlenty. And yet at the same time, as I pointed out to her that as I talked with our Commissioner of Finance, Ines, there didn't seem to be a lot of communication coming from the Wisconsin side. Because in Wisconsin, it needs to be a legislative issue. But they really were discouraged because there didn't seem to be a lot of feedback from Wisconsin to some of these offers. So in October, we held a border meeting with Wisconsin and Minnesota legislators. And it was really fascinating. We thought maybe we should do this more often to talk about some of our issues. And our staff were excellent to be able to review the numbers so we all heard the same thing at the same time and what the impact of reciprocity would mean if it was ended. But we also got into the bigger issue of that the benchmark study that determines the formula that has been used for a number of years is very, very dated. And that has been part of the discussion. And that was one thing that, you know, Governor Pawlenty did not put on the table. He was talking about, you know, the timing of the payments, but there's another issue of perhaps are the, you know, is this formula outdated? Perhaps not to the benefit of our state. And so later, the legislature from Wisconsin, when they realized it actually was that, you know, Minnesota had given them actually a pretty, you know, reasonable offer, they wanted to, you know, to make some connections so that the legislature from Wisconsin could begin to negotiate with Minnesota. And at that point, it was getting a little too late. You know, the forecast was coming out. But they really expressed an interest in, even though we were ending the reciprocity, they did not want us to just not come back and see if there was a way to reinstate it. And so my bill really looks at how might we redo the study so that we would have a new benchmark in the future to begin to restore it? The Wisconsin legislator, I've been working with Representative Ann Raychuk, who is from the St. Croix Falls area, and she has introduced a bill that's pretty much identical to my bill, the original language, because we believe we both have to be working together to make this happen. Now, again, the difference here is that our Commissioner of Finance can negotiate directly with the other state, and Wisconsin needs to be legislative action. The other thing that's different about Wisconsin is that they meet on a regular basis throughout the year. They have these mini sessions. They also can call themselves back into session. So they were prepared to potentially vote on this in November, even December of last year, in an emergency session. So essentially what my bill would do is that it calls on the Department of Revenue in both states to collect the data necessary to do this study. We would look at that happening for the 2010 tax year. So it's important for us to send a message that we want the information, you know, collected beginning in 2011 when those filings are made. And it starts to outline what we would like them, you know, to look at. Then it looks at reporting. And again, we would not be in session, but we would like to have a report by July 15th. Looking at what the data has said and where we're at in the negotiations. Another report would be in September 15th of 2011. Again, so we would be able to monitor what kind of negotiations are going on. We could not do anything as a legislature, but in Wisconsin they could. And then, you know, by that date, we need to start making a decision by probably November 1st if we can restore it for tax year 2012. That's very aggressive. And then we would have a final report in March of 2012. So it's a starting point that I know the department, to collect this data, would like to know that there's an effort on both sides to be able to really negotiate this. But it seems like, why is this a benefit? It's because I think that we're stronger as a region. We have reciprocity on other issues, and we keep talking about Wisconsin in terms of our businesses going back and forth across the borders, and we have to address that. But we really need to be a stronger region. We can compete, you know, across, you know, the country, across the world, if people see us as the upper Midwest. And we see a lot of that between Eau Claire and the Twin Cities as really a very strong corridor for development. So that's, you know, my bill essentially, and we're trying to, again, work with the Wisconsin legislature to keep those discussions going.
Commissioner Innes, do you want to add anything to this?
Chairman and members of the committee, this was a long and winding road regarding the reciprocity negotiations. I don't know how much interest the committee has in going over how we got to this point, but it certainly wasn't our intention going into the negotiations to end up feeling that the only option we really had was termination of the reciprocity agreement. But I think if anyone who steps back and objectively looks at it and the cost that it was incurring on the state of Minnesota, it was hard to come to any other conclusion. We just weren't able to get there with our counterparts in Wisconsin. And as you all know on this committee, I know Senator Pogemiller was the tax chair, there was ongoing issues and discussions about the reciprocity agreement and whether we were being under-reimbursed and whether, you know, the benchmark study needed to be renewed and those sort of things. And they were never resolved. And so I think Wisconsin was always under the impression that we really weren't, you know, serious about the agreements and really, really terminating the agreement. So it was a long and winding road. We tried our best to get to a place where Minnesota could at least make a rational decision to continue the agreement. It's worth remembering, when we entered negotiations back in June and July with Wisconsin, all we were asking for is acceleration of the payments. We weren't even talking about the flawed methodology and the benchmark study at that point. We thought, you know what, we're just going to ask for the $105 million to speed up, accelerate the payments. We'll address the other issues down the road, the methodology issues and the benchmark study. They weren't able to agree to speed up the accelerate the payments to the degree we needed them to. And so we ended up terminating the agreement, as you know, in September. We think Senator Saltzman's bill makes a lot of sense. A benchmark study is essential to reestablishing reciprocity. But there's beyond the benchmark study, we need to agree with Wisconsin about what is the revenue reimbursement that they're going to reimburse us. Because there's been a longstanding dispute going back more than a decade about what the definition of net revenue loss is for Minnesota. And so if you look at the revenue estimate, that's at $17 million that goes into the tails is a function of the fact that we believe that they're under reimbursing us for reciprocity. And when you look at how many taxpayers are impacted, they're very real, and we understand it's an inconvenience for taxpayers. Most people have been working and living under a reciprocity regime for 40 years. But if you look at, there's about 13,000 taxpayers in Minnesota will now be required to file dual returns. We're paying $17 million a year for that convenience. If you break that down per taxpayer, that's a subsidy, what do you want to call it, about $1,300 per taxpayer in order for their tax filing to be more convenient and only file a single return. To us, that didn't make rational public policy sense, and that we needed to address this in the best interest of the state to really address the reciprocity issue going forward. It's worth also mentioning that we don't have reciprocity with most states. We have a reciprocity agreement with North Dakota and Michigan, and that's it. And in those two states, there's no reimbursement payments. There's really no controversy. There's not enough people crossing the border each way to really make sense to have a reimbursement payment. So this is a unique agreement. There's been a longstanding controversy. I know the Senate Council did a really nice timeline about all the issues since the very enactment of reciprocity back in 1968. And for the most part, I think it served us well. But in the last 10 years, it's hard to sit down and objectively look at the numbers and say, you know what, this is in the best interest of the entire state of Minnesota. It may be in the best interest of the 25,000 people that cross the border from Minnesota to Wisconsin and from the 40,000 that cross from Wisconsin to Minnesota. But as a larger public policy matter, it just, and especially in these economic times, it just didn't make any sense.
And the timeline in the Senator Saltzman's proposal will work with you, and you think that the mechanism that they have in place for negotiations with the Wisconsin Department of Revenue are going to be helpful?
Chairman, I do. I think the timeline, as Senator Saltzman said, is an ambitious timeline because we will be using tax year 2010 data in order to do the benchmark study. Some of that data won't come in until the tail end of 2010, so we'll have about a year to do the study and try to get reciprocity enacted by tax year 2012. So it is ambitious. I think Senator Saltzman mentioned that the study may not be completed once we blink the lights back on a reciprocity, but hopefully by that point we'll have a firm agreement with Wisconsin about the parameters, what constitutes the settle-up payment, what constitutes the payment schedule, and so there won't be a lot of risk involved for Minnesota if we were to blink on reciprocity before ultimate completion of the study. So we think the timeline's workable. It's ambitious, but we think it's workable, Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Innes, Senator Erickson Ropes raised the issue of the responsibility or duties of the executive branch in this issue. And could you, is there a history that you know of that isolates that authority with the executive branch and not with the legislative?
Chairman, Senator Limmer, the statute that established reciprocity, asked 290.081, actually established the authority of the Commissioner of Revenue to terminate the agreement if he deemed it not in the best interest of the state of Minnesota. So it's that power is a function of statute.
And, Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
Commissioner, what do you understand, or could you reflect to us the reasoning why the legislature, through statute, isolated that authority with your office?
Commissioner.
Chairman, Senator Limmer, I'm not familiar with the legislative history of that provision. It was enacted in 1967, took effect in 68. I believe that part of the statute was part of the original enactment, that it gave the commissioner that authority. You know, I'm sure the discussions, I'm speculating, but I'm sure the discussions was, you know, this agreement may work today, but, you know, in 10 years or 15 years, there needs to be a mechanism to get out if it really is deemed not in the best interest. But having said that, the Wisconsin legislature did not give their executive branch comparable authority. So it was a little bit of a mismatch when we were negotiating. I was negotiating with my counterpart in Wisconsin. He didn't have the extent of the authority that we had to alter payments and make adjustments in the methodology. He would have had to gone back to his legislature and got legislative approval for any of those changes, for most of those changes. They have a fall session, so there was an opportunity, a window of opportunity there to get something passed in the Wisconsin legislature. And I had talked with the Senate Majority Leader and the House Majority Leader in that regard. But your Senator Lemire, your point's well taken. I mean, it is a unique feature, I think. And Wisconsin did not go down that road. They maintained more legislative authority over the reciprocity agreement.
And, Mr. Chair,
Senator Lemire.
This is a related thing. Maybe it doesn't have any connection, but depending on what we do on the income tax reciprocity, could it trigger any type of harsh feelings between the state of Minnesota and Wisconsin regarding the college tuition reciprocity agreement that we have? I know there's been discussion over the years regarding whether we should continue that, but would this in any way sour the present relationship as it relates to college tuition?
Commissioner.
Chairman, Senator Lemire, I know when we were talking about years ago, in fact, that the reciprocity statute for income tax reciprocity and higher ed tuition were actually linked. And a number of years ago, that linkage was severed to keep them separate and distinct. I know when Senator Saltzman and I have talked and we met with some of our counterparts in Wisconsin, we went out of our way to say we didn't want this to spill over into other issues involving the two states, that we really respect the relationship we have between the two states. And we wanted to keep this isolated just to the income tax reciprocity issue. And they concurred with that. And so I don't think there's always a possibility that this stuff could spill over into other areas. But we did our level-headed best just to keep it the discussion on this one issue and try to resolve it to the best of our ability. And I think they saw the merit in that. And, you know, Chairman, I'd also just like to reiterate a point. I think there's been a lot of confusion about this reciprocity agreement and what it means. And it's true that there's about 8,000 Minnesota taxpayers that will see a Wisconsin tax increase. And so there's nobody that's going to pay more in Minnesota taxes because of repeal of reciprocity. If there is any impact on their tax statement, it's going to be because they're going to be paying the Wisconsin taxes. And so I think we've got to make that clear, too, that the agreement was entered into back in 1968 as a convenience feature. Say, you know what, let's only file one return. It wasn't meant to insulate Minnesotans working in Wisconsin from higher taxes in Wisconsin. It happened to be a function of it over time, but that was not the original purpose for the reciprocity agreement. So I think there's some confusion. People think Minnesota's they're going to get paid more in Minnesota taxes. That is not true. It's Wisconsin tax burdens that $300 to $400 is the average for about 8,000 Minnesota taxpayers.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions, members? Just a comment, Commissioner. I would speculate that I hope this isn't an area where we will have regretted giving the executive branch authority that the legislature retained in other states. I can think of an example where we're having a little discussion with that right now. Anything else, members? Anything else, Commissioner?
Yeah, Chairman, just one more thing. Dr. Wilson just mentioned to me, thought it might be a good idea to mention that this benchmark study is a very labor-intensive process that we do. We can do it in-house, but it is very labor-intensive. I think back in 1995, when we did the last one, we had about $150,000 appropriation for this purpose. So I just wanted to say this is not a cost-free endeavor here, this benchmark study, and I just wanted to flag that for you. And I don't think this bill has an appropriation, but we can certainly work with the authors to discuss what the cost associated with such a benchmark study might be.
Sure, Commissioner. Well, Senator Saltzman.
So just one more point, Mr. Chair, is that I do want to acknowledge the commissioner because he really did go to the mat, and the Wisconsin legislature was not pleased with their administration and their inability or unwillingness to negotiate with the state of Minnesota, because in the end, the Wisconsin legislature clearly said and called when we all sat down and looked at the figures, they said, you know, Minnesota gave us one good deal. So, you know, I think that at the same time, when we have a significant budget deficit, we should be looking at, and, you know, the more political stuff in terms of the benchmark study was not on the table. It was a more reasonable acceleration, which their legislature was ready to accept. They were ready to go and call an extraordinary session so they could pass it. But at that point, we were sort of past that point. So I do want to, you know, really thank, you know, Commissioner Innes for being extremely willing to meet with us and Ms. Allen and Ms. Von Mush for going out to this, you know, border meeting. It was really, really helpful. And Senator Erickson Ropes has represented her community extremely well because it's her constituents who are really impacted by this, I think, of most areas, and Senator Prentner Solon as well.
Oh, well, Senators, this is off subject, so if we're done with the with regard to your border meeting, I do want to mention to you that Minnesota is a participant with South Dakota, North Dakota, and Manitoba in a legislators' forum. And the area legislators from that are close, we get together every year. And we talk about issues, and they range from flooding to meth control to drug courts to tourism to whatever, and a pretty successful group. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think maybe we should visit about expanding it or starting up something on the east and the south side of the state, because it's very helpful. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe some of this issue would have been resolved had you guys had a kind of an annual. We get together for a day and a half once a year, and it's pretty helpful. So,
Mr. Chair, it sounds like an excellent idea. And those
Senator
of us
Ropes.
Who live on border communities, we travel across those borders all the time. And I sit in southeastern Minnesota, so one of my borders is Wisconsin, and the other border is Iowa. So we have to be friendly with lots of people down there. So it just makes sense. And again, to that point, Mr. Chair, I think it only makes sense, again, to vest the authority for the tax reciprocity decision-making with the legislators so we are all on the same page.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I try regularly to visit with and speak with my colleagues in St. Paul. It's very successful.
it's a harder border to deal with.
I try to avoid that.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Thanks, Senator Erickson-Ropes. We'll lay Senate File 2599 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Saltzman. We'll lay Senate File 3017 as amended over for possible inclusion, and we'll work with you on the fiscal issues that are with regard to the study.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Phoebe. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Senator Phoebe. And members, we had a thorough review of this and other proposals in the property tax division yesterday. And so this provision we felt was timely and needed action. So we're moving this one to the floor so it doesn't get drug along with the rest of the stuff. But so that's why Senator Phoebe's here today. But we did have a real thorough review of this yesterday in division, and had good testifiers from your district, and was very informative. So Senator Phoebe, Senate File 2745.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for your consideration of Senate File 2745 this morning. We did have a thorough we had witnesses here yesterday from my district. I really just want to thank Jeannie Henderson, Jerry Kreitzik, John Cullen, and Commissioner Schmiesing for coming down from Sherburne County to testify yesterday on behalf of this bill and in support of. We also had Farm Bureau here, Chris Raddatz was here in support of this bill, and also the department. So with that, as we know, last year a series of events happened that have kind of gotten lumped into, especially out in the community, called fondly known as Green Acres. But as we all know, a number of events happened with agriculture property taxes in the last year, affecting greatly many landowners in my district. We're calling it out there the perfect storm, and in other places it's put tremendous strain on some of the farmers, especially in the areas of Sherburne County, Isanti County, and those areas of the state. The one bill before you, Senate File 2745, is a bill that, as I said, everyone has agreed on. There's a looming deadline date for people right now of May 1st to make some decisions with regard to their property. And with the effect of these changes, a number of things, there's a lot of people not ready for this. The landowners, the assessor's offices, the counties, I heard even as recent as 2 days ago, some assessor's office still aren't quite sure with all the rules and things, and they're telling some of their landowners that they need to hire surveyors to create new legal descriptions. I'm not sure that that's true. I really don't think it is, but there's confusion out there still. So what this bill does is ask for an extension in that date to August 16th so people will have bide some more time in making these really tough decisions.
Thank you, Senator Folby. And members, we probably were a little aggressive in our timeline that we set last year with regard to this. We do have good support from the department and the assessors, the farm organizations. Everybody would like to have a little more time for them to review their applications for this rural preserve program. Questions, members? Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I was going to say this is a good idea. I want people to understand it and be comfortable. And, Green Acres isn't as I think a lot is made of. But people need more time, and that's reasonable. So I'm happy to move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Anyone in the audience who wants to testify in opposition? Any other questions, members? Senator Dibble moves Senate file number 2745 be recommended to pass and referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Bill is referred. Thank you, Senator Folby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Clark. Welcome to the committee, Senator Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My testifiers seem to be on their way.
Oh.
I don't know. My understanding from my office is, are they? Oh, they're right here. Okay, good. There, this is good.
Ask a friendship. Really hard.
And your chair is still in education right now.
Well, Senator Clark, I would comment. I think that the tax committee is moving faster than the education committee is today. Senator Clark, Senate File 2229.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We're very glad to be here. I do have a couple of people from our local community, Patty Gartland from the city of Sartell and Mike Williams from the city of St. Cloud. This bill is about a six-community effort to upgrade our water treatment system, which I don't know how many of you have actually noticed where it is in our area. It's on right on the Mississippi, and a park is right on top of it. And so it is a critical place that we need to make sure that not only is our water clean for our people, but if you think about the Mississippi again being right there, it's critical. It has been overextended for a period of time. The communities have come together on this project. Senator Fischbach and my districts are both a part of this, so I want to acknowledge her help on this as well. But we have got the funding for the project, but we are here for a little help from the state on it to be able to complete it. And with that, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I think I'd like to have my testifiers speak more to exactly what we're looking for to help you better understand it.
Ms. Johnson or Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Mike Williams. I'm the city administrator in St. Cloud. Thank you for hearing us today. As Senator Clark suggested, the St. Cloud area wastewater treatment plant is owned and operated by the city of St. Cloud, but that treatment capacity is shared with other cities, those cities being Sartell, Sauk Rapids, Waite Park, St. Joseph, and St. Augusta. The plant's been in operation since the mid-70s, and we're embarking on a project that is pretty major. It has three components to it. It's a rehab of the pretty much 30-year-old facility. In addition to that, it's an upgrade of the treatment ability of the plant, so we will enhance the treatment of the wastewater. And thirdly, it's an expansion of the treatment capacity. excuse me, the project is a $43.5 million project, and it will increase the capacity from 13 million gallons a day to 18 million gallons a day. It'll do a better job of removing the phosphorus and nitrogen removal as required by new federal and state standards. So And while we have planned this, for example, the city of St. Cloud has increased its rates 8% for the last number of years in anticipation. We've applied for grants and other intergovernmental help to try to relieve the heavy burden that's happening on our ratepayers. But to date, we have only $300,000 in help from the federal government through a grant. So the tax exemption that could be granted by the state here would be very significant to the project.
Mr. Williams, you mentioned the federal government $300,000 commitment. Does that bringing along their formula for calculating the local effort on this program, which ties to the rate that your residents pay?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that grant has any requirements for us on rates.
Doesn't have any requirements that way. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Patty Gartland. I'm the Sartell City Administrator.
Ms. Gartland, I'm sorry.
That's all right. I also serve in the capacity as the chair of the St. Cloud Area Wastewater Advisory Committee. This is a committee that was actually created in 2001 as an outgrowth of a regional plan that was developed for the St. Cloud metro area. And it's a committee that focuses all of its time and energy on collaborating and coordinating functions and activities between the users of the contract users of the wastewater treatment plant and the city of St. Cloud. And over the course of the last 5 years, we've devoted our energy to trying to get all of the contract cities and the city of St. Cloud working together on the timing and a fair and equitable support for moving forward with this very large, very significant public infrastructure project. It is vital to our ability to be able to continue accommodating economic development and growth for the city of Sartell and the city of Sauk Rapids. From a capacity standpoint, this is particularly critical for our communities because our capacity allocations are at that point where we're not going to be able to accommodate continued growth and development. In Sartell, we've been very fortunate to be able to attract some new fairly significant development despite the downturn in the economy. We know what we have on the books now is pretty much going to take care of the capacity we have. So this is a very important piece of our ability to be able to continue accommodate economic development. We know that the state has been a partner in a number of other similar type projects that help facilitate economic development by doing this type of sales tax exemption. We really hope you'll be a partner with us in trying to make this project a reality. If we aren't able to, we are probably going to be in a position at looking at what is it that we can back out of the project to be able to bring those prices down. It's a great time to be doing construction, but when the economy is the way it is, we all are also looking at how we can pull it in and constrain it. So we look forward to the state's partnership with us on this by granting the sales tax exemption for the project.
Ms. Gartland, you mentioned the Sartell's ability to grow. Are you being impacted then by the impaired waters initiatives where you can't expand beyond your capabilities to treat, so you need to expand your treatment facilities?
That is actually part of the entire rehab upgrade. The three-part component to this project is both a rehab upgrade and expansion, so that is having an impact on that.
And is the state going to be playing a role through any of the WIF funds? Senator Clark, do you know, or Ms. Gartland?
To my understanding, we've made application to multiple state and federal funds. To date, other than the one that Mr. Williams referenced, that is the only one that we've actually had any success with.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Shauna Johnson, and I am the city administrator for the city of Waite Park. Just a few other highlights that I wanted to do in addition to Ms. Gartland and Mr. Williams. The project involving six different cities with six different councils has been kind of complex, as you probably all are aware. We have other issues that were really concerning for our community, in particular related to our sewer interceptor system. As we see the need to expand and rehab our wastewater treatment plant, our city alone is also going to be faced with over $7 million in rehab costs associated with our sewer interceptor system. This was something that our city really had to struggle with when we were looking at pursuing this, because from a capacity situation, our city wasn't at a situation where Sartell was. However, looking at it from a regional perspective, we understood the importance of being a partner in this today. If Wake Park would have chose not to move forward with it along with the other cities, the whole project would have had to be stopped. That's the way our arrangement works. So it's important for us to have recognized that. And I think the other important piece that I just wanted to touch on is that we're here just asking for the sales tax exemption. This is not something that we've requested any bonding money for. It's something that we're looking at being able to finance on our own. And we would be willing and encourage your support.
Thank you. How do the six communities work your rate structures? Are they all comparable, or are they up and down, or how do you work that? Senator Clark or somebody?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to let them speak to this, but I will tell you that this has been a stretch for all the communities, but in particular Wake Park and St. Augusta, this was really hard. And so if you think about capacity, St. Augusta and Rockville, I've been here before on some other issues in their communities that in 10 years from now will probably be in, you know, a pretty good financial growth pattern. But right now they're stretching. They're stretching so hard to even just remain cities.
And what are the monthly rates? What's the range?
Mr. Chair, I can just speak to you that the monthly rates are actually set by each individual city. I don't have a copy of that. I'm not sure if any of the other representatives here today have that information.
Mr. Chair, first, if I can answer more specifically your question about
Mr. Williams.
Yes, thank you. About the WIF funding, we have made application for that, I believe, in the last two rounds without success. So the wastewater infrastructure funding. The rate structure is based on a fairly complex formula based on how much capacity each city used and how much of the upgrade and of the rehab is the responsibility of each city. So we each indeed do establish our rates independent of one another, really, and in response to how that what that formula is requiring. So we would all be at different stages with our rates, and we've all had to raise our rates to different levels to meet this demand.
Well, the reason I ask is because Congressman Peterson has been very helpful bringing some federal USDA rural development money into our area for this very purpose. The problem with those dollars is they bring this federal requirement that I asked you about for local share along with them, and a lot of times that drives the monthly rate up for a typical home to $50 or $60 a month. And so I'm just trying to get a frame of reference as to what your kind of typical monthly charges are.
Well, Senator, I was just going to say that is not the fund that our $300,000 is coming from. It's an earmark through the Economic Development Agency through the federal government, so that those rules and regulations don't apply. And I too don't have our rates on the top of my head.
And would there be any reason that you wouldn't qualify for those funds?
We have applied for everything that we know that's available. Through both federal and state.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Clark.
The people with me are much more intimately knowledgeable about this, so I may be speaking out of turn. But as a regional center, there's some funds that we can't qualify for through rural development and others that we can. And so we, you know, as you know, it gets rural very quickly. It's certainly part of this area. It still has rural characteristics, but because it is a regional center, it does make it a little more challenging to figure out where we actually can get the resources.
Sure, very likely. Any other questions, members? Anybody else who would like to testify on Senate File 2299?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
Ms. Johnson?
If I could just add one other thing. The sales tax exemption is going to be an integral part of us as we move forward, from the standpoint that there are pieces of this project that as we move forward that we're going to have to look at very closely to determine whether or not we're going to be able to include them or not. And particularly from my community standpoint and looking at the cost that we're going to be facing with other parts of our sewer system, those are things that, depending upon the outcome of this, is going to probably give us the ability or not to continue doing the entire project or in parts.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if any of the cities know this, but are your water rates, are they based on consumption? The state passed a law several years ago requiring the rates to be encouraging conservation by charging more the higher rates used. And I know at my local city, they did the opposite of it. They raised the base fee so high that people who are using, say, 2,000 gallons a month of water were paying a lot higher rate per gallon than people at the high end. And I was just curious, when that law passed, I think 2-3 years ago, have your cities changed the rates? Is it such that people who use higher amounts are going to pay more per gallon, or do you know what they are in your cities?
Mr. Williams or
just for
anyone?
A second.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty. As you know, the outstate communities were not required to come into compliance with that regulation until I think next year. And so I can only speak for the city of St. Cloud about our rates, and we have been making those adjustments so that we're in compliance.
Mr. Chair, members
Ms.
of the
Gartland.
Committee. Patty Gartland again. For our city, and I think for some of our neighbors, the actual treatment plant itself and how we finance that is really coming from what we call a sewer access charge. And that's a charge that actually is borne by the development community. Our user rates are what we use to pay for the treatment aspect of the service. So for us, what we've done with our utility user rates has not been as impacted by preparing for this plant upgrade and expansion as our sewer access charge has been. And on the tiered, when in response to your question about the tiered rate structure, our city has been evaluating that. We've made some changes to it, and we're evaluating further changes to further extend that incentive or reward for water conservation. So we are aware of it, and we are working to put that philosophy in play.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
the only
Marty.
Reason I mention it is because, it won't affect this plant, but, I mean, the need down the road, I mean, that's the whole point of it. So, okay.
Correct.
Senator Ms. Gartland.
Mr. Chair, members of the council, one of the challenges I think we look at on both our water consumption and our wastewater consumption is how can we continue to reduce that. In water, how can we get people irrigating less, using treated water to irrigate? And those are things that I know all of our communities have been collaborating with one another on, sharing ideas and ways to make that happen.
Senator Clark.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, you know, our communities really have been working on conservation for a long period of time. And I remember even in the mid-90s when the city of St. Cloud went to volume-based garbage and changed what recycling was, it was hugely the difference. What I saw was being put out on the curb in our community. So it is something as a region that we continue to look at, both from a business and private industry standpoint, public and home consumption.
Anything else, members? Thank you, Senator Clark. Thank you all for driving down to St. Paul today. And Chair Lay, Senate File 2299 over for possible inclusion. Senator Bonoff. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Senator Bonoff, Senate File 2606.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 2606 is a bill that puts forward an extension for the construction of the hydroelectric plant on the St. Anthony Falls. And I originally carried this bill to have the extension a few years back. I think it was actually my first year in the legislature. And this was planned to be right on track except for the bridge collapsed. And so when that happened, everything had to stop, and they weren't able to finish their construction when they had planned. And actually, in your packets right now, you have maps. They're the Minnesota maps, and you might want to look at that because right on the front of it, you can see the area where this is taking place. So it should be in your today's material folders, the maps. Very good. So just on the front, if you want to take a look at where this takes place. And another interesting piece of trivia that I just wanted to share with the committee is that in the Minneapolis Institute of Art, there is a painting called Mill Pond by Fournier, and this painting was done in 1888, and it is of the same exact area. And the reason why this was of such significance that it was painted is because it was during that time that the federal government realized how important it was for that the Mississippi River was for power. And so because of that, they made Fort Snelling right in that spot, and it was a significant historical spot. So it's very interesting that today we come full circle and we are putting a hydroelectric plant there to generate power for this area. So this is a tax exemption that we had granted, and all we're doing is asking for one additional year.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff. And testifier?
Sure.
Senator, Chair, my name is Melissa Parker. I'm with Frederickson Byron on behalf of Brookfield Renewable Power. Thanks so much for considering this bill today. I think it's important to note that the exemption here was granted in 2006 to cover until calendar year 2009. When the project was just about to complete the pre-construction requirements of its FERC license, the 35W bridge collapsed. And as you can imagine, and I don't know if you've had a chance to take a look at your maps, but the project is only 400 feet from the 35W bridge. In fact, if you're standing on the project, this is what you see. You look right up at it. And so essentially, the Army Corps of Engineers, who's a partner on this project, looked at the project developer and said, you know, thanks, but no thanks. Don't call us. We'll call you. So what we did is we went to FERC, which is the people that grant us the license to develop the project. They offered us a two-year extension on both the time to begin the construction work, which was extended until February 10th of 2010 this year, and gave us until February 10th of 2012 to complete the project. I'm happy to say that the project actually broke dam, if you will, on April 27th of last year, and we are actually planning on being in service and generating 9.6 megawatts of clean, renewable power beginning October of this year. So thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Senator Marty.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this project, obviously because of bridge collapse, has a reason to extend it. I'm always puzzled how many of these tax exemptions, sales tax exemptions we have for construction materials, that they do have to come back and do it. I picture it wouldn't be any harder politically for somebody trying to pass a sales tax exemption and say, oh, I'd like, if we're expecting it to be done in 2 years, to ask for 4 years at the beginning or something, because it seems like we have time after time we have these bills extending it. Maybe when we're drafting these, we ought to think about extending it a year longer than we think we'd need. But, I mean, this is obvious reason for doing it. It's not that there's any reason not to do it, but I'm just saying that.
Yeah, this would have obviously not anticipated.
You couldn't predict,
but maybe
this
we
one.
Should be more thorough, right, in our discussion with the communities that are bringing these proposals forward as to when they actually think they're going to get them done and what are realistic timelines. Anything else, Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For folks who were looking at the map, wondering exactly where this is, if you see the little structures just beyond the 35W bridge, that's a U.S. Army Corps of Engineer facility, and it's just using one of those squares, if you will, one of those chambers is where the hydroelectric generating facility will be. So it's a pretty interesting project. It takes advantage of existing infrastructure and a cooperative agreement with the Army Corps. And we also, for folks who may not be aware, are also supporting this through REPI payments that come out of the RPS. So they're receiving some of their production incentive payments as well. And this is baseload energy, which is also interesting, even though it's renewable. But the flow of the water is constant and steady enough that it's 9.6 megawatts of what's considered to be baseload energy. So it's a pretty good project.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I can't quite see it on my map. It's not magnified enough.
Yeah, it's interestingly, it's even though it's so small, it's new turbine technology that's really efficient. And so it generates a lot of energy with relatively small turbines.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, on that, Senator Dibble, do you know how much the power in the past was able to generate, the previous turbine there years ago? I'm just curious because I have a feeling it's a lot less.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I would guess to generate that much, they probably need to use the entire facility and have like four turbines to generate similar. So it's a vertical turbine. Makes better use of the falling, you know, the power from the water falling. It's pretty interesting.
That's right. There's actually, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's actually 16, essentially they look like box fans, and they're 2 feet by 2 feet. There's two on a string. They're lowered, and they have the ability to raise them through a crane to clean them and things like this, but they're lowered into the current profile of the lock and dam, so you know, it won't have any sort of aesthetic change to the look of the structure as well.
Thank you. Senator Pogemiller.
Chairman, there are two of these projects in my neighborhood, and this is one that the neighborhood does support, so yes. I'd like to move that Senate file 2606 be
laid over for or inclusion.
Laid over? Can't go on its own? There's an omnibus bill, I take it.
I think it's an omnibus bill.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, thank you for trying.
Senator Pogemiller moves Senate file 2606 be recommended to pass and laid over for inclusion. Possible inclusion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Same sign. Motion prevails. Bill's laid over. Thank you, Senator Bonhoff. Thank you. Thank you all. Committee's adjourned.